Good morning, everyone. Have to do a little disclaimer here in the introduction. I guess you heard I'm a developmental and clinical psychologist. I have had no formal training in public health, but I want to tell you a little bit about how I became such an avid amateur at it. One of them had to do in my training to be a clinical psychologist, which came from my own experiences of being really interested in how humans develop. I was interested in anything that furthered the development of a human, that made them feel more worthwhile, more fulfilled, and enriched their life. Unfortunately, in my discipline, it looked at it very individualistically. And in my practice at Mass General for many years, I learned how to diagnose, treat patients, train psychiatrists and clinical psychologists. But my goal was to go home again and actually to work for Indian Health Service and take care of some of the problems in Native communities. So once I got my feet on the ground with my work at Mass General, I started branching out and consulting a little bit and working with some of my Native friends in the Northeast. And I found out my whole thinking about individual health was a little bit off. And wasn't helping me as much deal with the problems in the community. So, you know, first I was called in to work on a substance abuse grant up in Maine. And, of course, the very first problems were how to get people that were dealing with these issues to the people who had the expertise or getting the people with the expertise to even come to these rural places. And then after that, who was going to deal with whether there was anything in their life that was worth looking forward to? No jobs, no future in some of the community. So it was sort of a wake-up call for me to think differently. And I was brought back over across the river to Harvard to launch a project on the Harvard Indian Health Initiative, which my job then was, the way I saw it, was to steal resources from all the schools at Harvard and try to address the many inequities and inequalities in Indian country. So I would go call or my colleagues and say, come on, let's go, you know, to Pine Ridge, let's go to Fort Peck, let's go to, you know, let's do some good work out somewhere. And I found that there were some cultural things I didn't know about people who hadn't had this exposure or background in Native country. It was a shock to them, and not many of them could actually function very well when we hit those places. Some of my colleagues that were very, very well trained, when I took them to certain communities, it was like they had PTSD because they hadn't dealt with those kinds of situations in a live community. They saw people in their offices, people that could make it to their offices, and didn't have to think about all the rest of the things. So that's where I took a pretty deep turn. Part of it was by accident, and I inherited a course called Nation Building, Native Americans in the 21st Century, Nation Building 2, which was a field research course that was taught at Harvard, first started by Joe Kalt. And basically, he was an economist, and his work was to get graduate students to work on economic development and issues of culture in Native communities. And they could be graduate students from any school. They could be dental school, law school, business school, Kennedy school, ed school. But his expertise was at economics. When I took it over, my expertise was mental health, and I had to start looking at projects on, you know, government reform, constitutional reform, economic development. But thank goodness there was a lot of health and social service concerns that made me feel adequate, and somewhat so in education. And I think what's come out of this and what I'd like to share with you today is a model that's become very important to me about building healthy communities. And I say that in the largest sense because every project I've ever worked on, and let me just, this is the name of the course. This is the 14th year it's been supported by the Harvard University Native American Program. It's currently listed at the Kennedy School of Government and the Graduate School of Education. More recently, we just got it listed in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, and it's open to students from anywhere in the university. So since I've been doing this course, we've done 94 projects with 161 students that are enrolled in all these different schools. You can see the Kennedy School, Divinity, Public Health, Law, Extension, the college, a couple of students from MIT, Suffolk, and Boston. And there's a breakdown of the project focus with economic development, education, health and social services, and government as possibly a primary focus. But again, what I found out in doing this course was that everything was about building healthy communities. So when I first inherited this course, I thought I was totally incompetent to take on these projects. But what I underestimated was the resourcefulness of the graduate students and the students. And I was also working with communities who designed their own projects. It's not what we wanted to do, it's what they wanted to do. So it was a great resource for them to use our students to do background research, to collect examples of best practices anywhere out there in the world, and to work with these tribal communities or native organizations on addressing a problem that they wanted. But just a little bit about nation building principles. And I know that I'm talking about a specialty group of people, but a lot of people don't talk about American Indian identity. And really, it's not ethnic or racial, it's political. And the nation building principles bring that in, that citizens of native nations are just that, citizens of a sovereign nation. And their identity revolves around that. It has a lot of different features, and one of the key ones is sovereignty matters. And this has been a very strong element, especially since the self-determination movement has been institutionally somewhat supported since the 1960s, after many, many decades, and you could say many decades of it being denied. But what we know about nation building is that sovereignty matters. We have to pay attention to that. Culture matters, institutions matter, and leadership matters. And the reason I say this is we have to orient our students to these principles and make them realize no matter what content they're working on, what health or educational project, you cannot separate out the infrastructure, the legal structure, the constitutional structure, the culture, the history, and all the political things that are going on in a community if you're going to address any particular element in the community. It certainly makes it complex, but it sure makes it interesting when we discuss the different projects that comes up. So what makes a nation-building project, and I'm right in the process right now of soliciting them, is it's field-based research. It's requested by a client that focuses on some major issue in Native American tribes that the tribes or nation faces. It's a sovereign choice of a community to partner with the university to study Native issues toward building healthy communities. And I want to reiterate, the choice of what to work on comes from the community. We're facilitators. The typical topics are health, social welfare, education, economic development, constitutional reform, leadership, land, water rights, culture, and language preservation. I'm the primary person who guides these projects. I get outside help from other faculty. Sometimes we've had issues of law, issues of government, issues of business where we've gotten help from some of the other professors around the university to refine the project and get higher level consultation. And then the goals of the course are first and foremost to serve the community client, to promote equal, respectful exchanges of knowledge between the university and Native communities, and to introduce current challenges and topics to Native and non-Native graduate students. I say this because I don't know how it is in some of the communities you might work, but there's a very strong history and paranoia in Native communities about researchers. And it's for good reason. There have been many researchers who've done all kinds of work in all kinds of disciplines in Native communities, but brought nothing back to the community. I actually personally know some communities that will not even allow any research in their communities because of this history. So again, I'm talking about this equal and respectful exchange of knowledge, sometimes with distrusting communities. It makes it easier, having a Native background and being familiar with that, but that doesn't make it even simple for me to go to places and with Native communities that don't know me, or, you know, when you represent a university, I carry some of that baggage. So I have to establish a relationship that proves that we will be respectful. And I think the other thing that about this particular way of learning and addressing some of the public health issues out there is that it opens up a new generation of people to a group of disenfranchised people, often with the inequalities that are well known in Native communities to non-Natives. Many of these students have never talked to a Native person before they've taken this class. When they take this class, not only do they have to talk to their client, they have to do a site visit, go visit the community, stay with them, meet other community members, and actually see it on the ground before they come back and finish their project. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the health and social service projects, just to give you a little bit more in-depth view of how these projects can turn, because they tend to surprise me every year. One of the very first ones we did is still one of my favorites. It was Tribal Considerations for Participation in Studies Collecting DNA. We did this for One Sky Center in Oregon Health Sciences University. It's a Native program that provides resources for tribes all over the United States. And the reason for doing this is that researchers had hit pretty heavy in a lot of Native communities to collect DNA for various different kinds of studies. There have been several disasters around this, but Havasupa is probably the most well-known case where that researchers went in there, the community thought they were studying diabetes. The community found out later that they were doing migration studies and schizophrenia studies with their DNA. It raised the issue of informed consent. But even more interesting from a perspective of IRBs, the difference between individual consent and community consent. When you're doing studies like this in small communities where people participate, it reflects upon the whole community. So do individuals have the right to consent to something that might have an effect on the whole community? Which, you know, I don't know about your university, but mine does not think like that. So, you know, we did this project with the hopes of getting guidelines that have been used by many people for tribes to consider setting up their own IRBs, what it would take, what expertise, and for them also to think about the legal implications for intellectual property rights out of this stuff. Another example was on methamphetamine and Pine Ridge options for combating its use. This was one of those projects when we got on the ground and we found out what was going on. It was such an easy problem to attack, not the use of methamphetamine, but why it wasn't being addressed is because nobody was talking to one another. None of the different departments, you know, behavioral health, law enforcement, judiciary, you know, our students went out there and tried to talk to people, and they could talk to them individually, but nobody had talked to each other. So the diagnosis of that particular problem was pretty easy to start with, and that's an example. We've done historical trauma with the Pequot. This is one of those that we don't put out there because it's a private experience for them that they want to explore, you know, how that's affected their community and how there might be possible treatments or ramifications to new learning. Barriers to foster care placement in Northern Cheyenne. The placement of children removed in Native families is really difficult. We do have an act that requires that they be placed in Native homes if at all possible. But given that, if you live in a tribal community and a child's been removed from somebody, you don't live that far away from them, and they know you've got their kid, and they may be abusing substances, they may have all kinds of other problems. It's sort of a scary thing to bring this kid into your house under foster care. So we were exploring all the different options of them still keeping their kids in their social order, but still living with some of the dangers of child removal. People Yeah, I've got 5 minutes. People ask me about, you know, whether these projects lead to other things. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, many of these get repeated and we go back to communities and build on other things. Sometimes they've led to grants. One time, one project 5 years ago led to the building and the opening of the Shinnecock Preschool that just opened this last year based on the project the students did. One project in the wellness program at Fort Peck. It's taken 4 different projects, but we finally have a totally built school intervention where almost all the health care, mental health care, and dental care is done in the schools for the kids because it wasn't getting done anywhere else. And in fact, that program just won high honors at Honoring Nations last week in San Diego. So there is the option of following up on some of these programs. So the challenges, as I talked about, have been, you know, the relationship of universities with American Indian and Alaska Native communities, the timetable. It's difficult to execute a substantive project in one semester. Focusing the problem is hard because many of the communities that want to work on a project, the problem seems so large it's hard to narrow it down to something that could be done in a semester. My personal problem is the expense for paying for the site visits for the students. I have to raise money for that, and it takes about $20,000 to $25,000 a year to fund the site visits. And then the other is we have limited resources for follow-up. But to speak about the future of what I've been talking about in this kind of a model, I would really love other universities to develop similar models. We've worked with the University of Arizona and done some partnership nation building and actually shared students on some cases. University of Washington actually duplicated this program and is doing it just on Native health. They're just focusing on health issues there. But we're looking for more partners that can follow up and have some interest in this kind of a relationship with the community. And I just must say about universities, because universities have a lot of control and power over who gets to function in what different careers. And universities have been beneficial to all of us, I'm sure, here for what we're doing. But, you know, their perspective on some of these things in these kinds of communities from a global perspective is lacking. And I feel that this kind of a interaction with universities and communities expands the notion of what knowledge is in a university. It expands the notion of what humanness is and what human needs are. So that's my wish, and be happy to discuss this. Thank you.